Every single one of you, you are all going to have to fight to control your posts. It's going to happen. All talking the world, all that authority you think you have, that just, whew, that goes out the window when some cat out there wants to try it.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 404 for the week of 25th, 2022. I am questionable red roof in product placement, David T. Cole. And I'm here with rejected crab, Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm small as fuck.
Secret flutist, Tara Ariano.
Loutist. Oh, that's not for a few episodes.
And unforgivable haircut, Santiago Melihuber.
Believe it or not, this man used to be fuckable.
I mean, we can talk about that. I dispute the used to be, as Sarah and I discussed on Slack earlier today.
Yes,
but anyway.
At length. Can I break in just quickly? Dave,
please.
You said it was February.
Did I?
Did you?
Yes.
I didn't even hear it.
Oh, my God. Wow. Well,
so
we're just going to run with it.
Okay.
Okay.
So welcome to Extra Hot Great. It's April, not February. And we are here with formerly a journalist, currently mentally stable. You've heard him on this podcast before. It's Santiago Melihuber. Welcome.
Santiago.
Hi. So glad to be back. Thank you all.
We're here to talk about We Own This City, and that the city of Baltimore had a policing problem became national news after the police murder of Freddie Gray in 2015. But around the same time, the DEA was investigating the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force, an elite group of cops who were supposedly recovering illegal weapons but were actually executing baseless searches and stealing drug money. Eventually, 8 of the 9 members of the task force were charged with crimes related to the corrupt enterprise, but the investigation was still making headlines as of this year and still is, as far as I can tell. We Own This City is a 6-part scripted series adaptation of the book of the same name by Justin Fenton, featuring, among many others, the formerly or still fuckable John Bernthal as Wayne Jenkins, our POV task force character, Josh Charles as a cop who's an even bigger pig than Jenkins, Wunmi Misako as a Department of Justice investigator looking into the BPD's civil rights violations, and Dagmara Domenchik and Don Harvey as FBI agents working on the criminal case against the cops. This series comes from David Simon, creator of Homicide and The Wire, and George Pelicanos, his frequent collaborator of recent years.
And...
Car Terrace.
But also, of course,
the city of Baltimore.
Yes. Let's do the Chen check-in. Santiago, should our listeners watch We Own This City?
No.
Oh, Sarah.
Qualified, yes.
Dave.
I'm going to say, if you wish there was a 6th season of The Wire called Bad Police, maybe, but yeah. I was bored.
Okay. I mean, I thought it was interesting, but I agree with Sarah. It's definitely not going to be for everyone, and it's not even for everyone on this panel, so let's get into it.
Right.
Santiago, when I reached out to you about coming on for this episode, you made sure I knew you are anti-cop. I felt like you and the show agreed about that, but having seen it, do you think it goes hard enough? It sounds like no.
It's not a matter of whether or not it goes hard enough. It's a matter of whether or not I enjoyed watching it.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I did not enjoy watching it.
Mm-hmm.
There is just no joy to be found in this show at all. Like, even in the darkest dramas, there are peaks and valleys where you get some relief between particularly tense scenes. But this show opens with imagery of police brutality by mostly white cops against black men, and it just really does not let up from there. I guess the main person that we're supposed to be rooting for is the woman from the civil rights office of mm-hmm. the DOJ.
Yeah, Ms. Steele.
Famously, I don't know anybody's name.
That's fine.
In anything.
Hooray, another one. Yay.
Yeah, but I mean, this is based on a true story, and even those scenes with her don't offer any relief if you are a person living in the world, because you know that this office is underfunded. The establishing shot of the office is just like a taped up piece of paper on a door saying Office of Civil Rights. So, you know, like, no one cares about this. You know that even if they are able to prosecute or successfully get some cops fired, that's the exception rather than the rule. She's not going to be able to change the system that created these cops and that is continuing to create corrupt cops. So there is really no real hope in this. I don't know if they're supposed to be, but you would expect there to be at least some levity somewhere, and I could not find any. The timeline of the whole show is very confusing. It jumps around a lot. I never know what year it is at any given moment. Is it 2015, 2017, 2003? It just made it very hard to follow. And finally, I'll just say, it is the year of our Lord with an E, 2022. If you have a scene that takes place in 2015, I do not need to hear the sentence, quote, "There's no way Trump even gets the nomination and no way he can win."
Thank you.
Yeah.
Amen. Amen, Lord with an E. Seriously.
I'm so glad everybody's in good health and has nothing contagious to offer.
This is really my primary qualifier, is that there is so much didactic exposition, and like, you have a good enough team of actors that it can take you like a minute or a minute and a half sometimes to realize that there is this very didactic, like, oh, they've sent a new lawyer into this like legal strike force so that Ms. Steele can explain to him and the viewer what's going on. And for a David Simon property, that's like actually a little disconcerting, to be like, actually, I don't want my handhelds. Like, just drop us in it and let us like swim to shore or drown. That's one of the great things about The Wire. Like, this is capital M my shit, and it just still is not quite there. Like, our esteemed colleague James Poniewozik in the New York Times said, it's a strong editorial, but that does not make for a great show. And I think that's about where I am. Like, once I sort of started watching it, it was easy enough to get back into those like homicide-y, wiry rhythms of the show, and to see these familiar faces like Jamie Hector of Bosch, and of course The Wire is back basically playing his Bosch character with a different name. Fine. Gabrielle Carteris as a section chief, extra fine. Love seeing her there. The actor who played Poot rolling through as like some sort of like on the other side of the law functionary, the guy who played Santangelo, like, I loved seeing these like greatest minor hits of The Wire staff. Bernthal's great. He commits to the accent, but it's just like, I understand why this was made. And once I started watching it, it was easy to kind of let myself just marinate in it. But once I stopped watching it, it was also very easy to stop watching. Because it's just not quite good enough.
You know, having watched five seasons of The Wire and seeing familiar rhythms there, my brain wanted to get into it. But this show's problem is it's got no snap. It's celery that you forgot to put in water, and like 3 days later, you pull it out of the crisper, and it's like, boing, boing, boing. And then, you know, like, it's sort of like that. It's like, oh, I can eat it. I know it's celery, but it doesn't have that snap. And it's sort of like that. It just is missing. And I don't know, because it's like based on a true story, and they feel pressure to sort of like follow the narrative line to a fault, maybe. But like, it doesn't have, as San Diego would say, it doesn't have those sort of like moments that let you enjoy it as entertainment, and then it can pull you in on its message as well. Like, where's the scene of the two cops just saying, fuck? Or, you know, where's your Omar Little? Where's your Strigger Bell sort of characters that you can get into on a sort of a pop culture level that will put the asses in the seats, and then you can, you know, give them their medicine. And that show isn't here quite, you know what I mean? There's little flickers of it now and then, but it doesn't really seem to have that throughput. And I kind of feel like I wish they took a step back and said, why don't we just inspired by a true story, this, and make this season six of The Wire, you know, and make it like shit cop season.
Or go the other direction and just make it a docu-series.
Make it a documentary,
Or, I mean, even Mayor of Easttown had those moments, like with the mom and the priest uncle, like just having Manhattans and these people joking with each other. And there was like a little tiny gossamer thread of hopefulness in it that would give you a rest, like Santiago said. this, I agree, doesn't have that. And it also, I think, like, Bernthal's good. Like, the haircut is not, but he's
who gave
good,
him that haircut?
But I don't think I understand why he's such a, like, primary POV character. Does anyone else feel like if he were sidelined a little bit and they focused more on the, like, internal affairs side of it, that it would be better? Or is it just a tonal issue?
I think it would have improved it if Ms. Steele, maybe if she were the primary focus,
mm-hmm.
it could have been a better narrative.
Yeah. And she's really good and very charismatic. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's good. It's just, I mean, I think Santiago's really onto something, that it's just unrelenting, kind of. And lectury also. Like, this mm-hmm. is too much explainy.
It felt like homework.
Yeah, kind of.
Sounds like that's what Dave was saying, too.
Yeah, I did learn that, however, you can get Chipotle in a holding room. So that was news to me. You want a coffee from the vending machine?
Maybe
no,
crime
please,
does pay.
Please go down the street and get me some Chipotle. I would like a burrito bowl with sofritas, veggies, cheese, a little lettuce, no sour cream.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like...
Guac is extra.
It is always.
Not if you're a cop. They just take it. They just give it to them.
Guac for cops program.
Yeah, I agree about that. It might have been better as a docu-series, but I also think it would have gotten less of an audience that way.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
I can understand why it was thought, like, let's put actors in this and that'll be the sugar, you know, to help the medicine go down.
Yeah.
And the mournful jazz soundtrack. It's not helping. Yeah. No more mournful jazz, please.
We also do meet Detective Souter, played by Jamie Hector from The Wire and Bubba Babosh, who seems to be the avatar for any or all of the decent characters in the department. But as the story goes on, I think the show also makes it clear how impossible it is even for cops like him to fight against the corruption in the department, which is like, this is something that you so rarely see on other scripted cop shows where it's like, you know, anytime there's a whistleblower story, it's like, the whistleblower's the hero, hooray for the whistleblower. And then in real life, it's like, oh no, the whistleblower got murdered probably by cops under extremely
right.
shady circumstances.
This team has basically already told us, like, I feel like we already got this
yeah.
from The Wire, or for that matter, from Babosh.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because it's an overt noir, like, yeah.
I'm a television completionist, and we got screeners for the first 3 episodes, and that's it for me. I'm done.
Yeah.
But, you know, I interviewed Dagmara Domincic about it. This is part of a big year for her. She was also in The Lost Daughter, and she has a big role in an Apple TV Plus series coming out later this year. But I made sure to ask her, like, how did you pick this? Because it was not Olivia Benson. She was basically like, yes, like, I, you know, I didn't want to do the interrogations and I also didn't want to run. And I admired that. So we'll link to that at that interview at Vanity Fair. But it sounds like we're all set on this for now.
Yeah.
It's time to go around the dial. Our first stop with Tara. Tara, what do you have?
Hello.
Hi.
This truly has been springtime for scammers on TV. We talked about The Dropout last month. Sarah and I used our around the dial time to separately talk about Inventing Anna and Super Pumped, about the Soho Grifter and Uber, respectively. Now, I'm going to close this chapter of culture by telling you about We Crashed. This was an 8-part series on Apple TV Plus. It just ended last weekend. It stars Jared Leto in an only moderate amount of facial prosthetics this time as Adam Newman, the founder of WeWork. Quick sidebar about this. It also relates to John Bernthal's haircut. As tech lunatics go, Adam Newman was, if you look him up, more conventionally attractive than most. No offense to tech lunatics, I guess, but
yeah.
you would not look at a photo of him and say Jared Leto should play him. Like, he's
no,
more of a...
No, wouldn't.
I would say Liam Hemsworth is, like, closer nose-wise, but anyway.
Mm-hmm.
They try to fuck up Jared Leto's face a little by giving him this nose putty, which only changes the bridge, but not the nostrils, which is where you really notice the difference way more. But I have to echo what Jesse Klein said on Last Culturistas last week in reference to Jessica Biel playing real-life axe murderer Candy Montgomery in a real fucked-up perm wig in the mm-hmm. forthcoming Hulu series Candy, which I watched all the screeners of that this weekend, and I'm sure I will talk about that when it comes out. But there's a lot of debate these days, Jesse Klein said, about which actors can or should play which characters, but the real candy is a 4, 5, 6 at best, and Jessica Biel is a 10. Jesse Klein feels 10 should not play 5s. I agree. If you saw the completely unrecognizable Jared Leto in House of Gucci or Colin Farrell in The Batman, you know what we're talking about. Obviously, you can't hire the actual Jeffrey Tambor to play that particular Gucci in 2021, but hire a character actor who looks like that. Instead of putting Jared Leto in Jeffrey Tambor drag, 10 should not play 5s. I stand with Jesse Klein, but I digress. Given what you may know about the cult that Jared Leto started in the late 2010s with his band 30 Seconds to Mars, it feels very natural to see him acting like a cult leader at fucking WeWork. The cult, by the way, was maybe a joke and maybe not. We'll link something in the show notes. He's nominally the lead of the show because his character is the CEO of a scammy company. But now that I've seen the whole season, I kind of think the real lead is Anne Hathaway, who plays Adam's wife, Rebecca Paltrow Newman. Yes, that Paltrow. Gwyneth is her cousin. We definitely see her trading on the name. She's had a bunch of different jobs for short stints in the way of people who come from money. But when she meets Adam, she's teaching yoga. The rest of the bullshit she's able to enact once she and Adam having a lot more money all kind of proceed from the mind of someone who would be very serious about yoga. Again, no offense to yoga people. She has this delusion about the mission of WeWork being to raise the world's consciousness as though the company is not just a landlord. Like, I've often thought Anne Hathaway was annoying. I feel like this is not controversial. I think she knows that too about her image and is really using that to develop the character hilariously. Like, she has to be the biggest asshole in most scenes. She goes for it every time. She's also a 10 playing a 6. The real Rebecca is more like a Janelle Maloney, but you know with every moment Anne Hathaway has absolutely nailed Rebecca's vibe to the wall, so I will allow it. And obviously you go into the show like this knowing that the reason it was made is because WeWork was a scam and it collapsed. Seeing something that was not a bad idea get spun out of control because the person in charge didn't know how literally anything works on a practical level, yet got people to keep giving him more and more money is fascinating. And having watched all the scam shows, although I bailed on the Uber one after the first episode, I would say The Dropout is the best. We Crashed is a close second. It almost seems like a secondary scam how much money they got out of Apple to make it. It looks so expensive. And if you wished Anthony Edwards had had more of a chance to yell at Anna in Inventing Anna, good news, he's in this too, yelling at Adam. And as I said, all of the episodes are now up on Apple TV+. I didn't say up top. These are both shows that think they're highbrow and are very middlebrow. The second one is The Baby. The show that premiered after Barry on HBO this weekend, last weekend, is a British co-production called The Baby. Our protagonist is Natasha, an intentionally childless chef in London. One of her best friends has recently had a baby. Early in the premiere, the other tells her she's pregnant. Natasha's kind of rude to both of them about it, so she goes out of town to try to figure out why she takes all of this motherhood so personally. And then at her rental cabin, someone suddenly dies outside. Seconds later, a baby falls off a cliff into her arms. Without getting into specifics, many people, the baby, capital T, capital B, never gets a name, comes into contact with, end up dead. Natasha tries to pass him off to the cops in the town near where she was staying. They take him, but when she returns to London, she opens her front door to take the trash out, sees the baby is sitting on the mat in the laundry basket that she was using as a makeshift car seat. And when she brings him inside, tries to close him in one room while she figures out what to do, she sees he's materialized in the room with her again. This baby's bad news. But where did he come from? What does he want? The show is called a horror comedy. It is darkly funny. What a little shit this baby is and how much Natasha does not want him around even before it becomes clear he has supernatural murder powers. I only got to see 6 of the 8, so I don't know if the tone changes back to be more comedic by the end, but the comedy kind of runs out about 3 episodes in. It's still good. It's just not as funny.
Yep, here's your problem. Someone set this thing to evil.
That's right. I will say, if you're a parent or aspiring parent of an infant, maybe just add this one to your watch list and check it out in a few years or 10. You have enough to worry about without this little turd worming his way into your mind. But if, like me, you never wanted children, and you never will, this will only confirm all of your beliefs. And frankly, more of culture should, in my opinion. I reviewed this Vanity Fair, and we will link that in the show notes as well. That is my plug.
Santiago, what do you got for us?
The latest season of RuPaul's Drag Race finally wrapped up. Woo! After what felt like several years of non-eliminations and queens coming back. The finale was the first time that there were five queens in the finale, which was a lot.
That's a lot.
However, I will say that the finale took a baby step in the direction of how I wanted the finale to go for a few years now, which is moving away from the lip sync off setup that started and should have ended with season 9. Sasha Velour's rose petals set an impossibly high bar that in trying to exceed it, queens just kept, I'm not going to say anything disrespectful. These queens are great. They're extremely talented and it is a wonderful art form, but they're trying and failing to top Sasha Velour every single time. And so they should have just ended on a high note with that and moved towards giving each queen maybe 5 or so minutes to do a solo performance of their choosing, which is if you want to lip sync to your own original song, do that. If you want to do stand-up comedy, do that. If you want to do ballet or some kind of performance art, whatever is most pertinent to you and your talents, showcase that. And then pick a winner between three queens, no more than three, not four, not five. So with this finale, they kind of moved in that direction that I had envisioned, where each queen gives an individual performance to a very bad song they clearly did not write or sing. However, I am glad about the result and the final two who did go on to lip sync. Going into the finale, I was saying, I really want Lady Camden to win as a new San Francisco resident. She is near and dear to my heart as a hometown hero.
Spoilers ahoy!
And if Lady Camden can't win, I want Willow Pill to win. So imagine my joy when the top two was Lady Camden and Willow Pill.
Just kidding. We were going to do the spoiler music, but it aired 4 days ago. If you cared, you watched it.
Yeah.
If you cared, you watched it. If you didn't want to be spoiled, it was all over social media.
Yes,
like,
it was.
Too late.
Yeah, it was.
If I spoiled it for you, sorry. And Willow Pill, she's a great queen. She is going to have such a fun reign. And she is so smart. She knows what she's doing. She ended that episode by saying, quote, "Most of all, I need to thank Cornbread's ankle." And if you know, you know.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, especially five queens is too much, especially when you can look at that field and go, OK, two of these plainly do not belong here and have been skating by because they were good TV for way too long. Plus a very lucky chocolate bar.
It's entirely. Oh, my God. The chocolate bar thing was so dumb. Mm-hmm. And like Rue had double saves anyway without the chocolate bar. So what was the point of all that?
Right.
And like we know that it wasn't random. Production just gave it to the one they wanted to save. Anyway, RuPaul definitely seems like the kind of person who would complain about participation trophies. So to keep saving people week after week and then just put everyone in the finale is too much.
It just seemed to be going on for like 14 months, too.
It was
like the NBA playoffs, like, you know, teams that are under 500 are playing. And it started a year and a half ago. What are we doing?
I was half expecting the next season of Queens to walk into the workroom. And then there's Diabetti and Angeria, like, still each one trying to just go home at that point because they haven't seen their family in 4 years.
Yeah.
Exactly. God.
And for my plug, Tara referenced it at the top of the show. For about a decade, I was a reporter, blah, 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 pandemic burnout, left the career last year and moved to San Francisco. But I have kind of wanted to scratch the itch of reporting a little bit. I've been thinking about this for a while, about launching a newsletter, and it's finally happening. Thanks to a certain billionaire buying up the Bird app and realizing I probably need to switch my hyperfixation onto a different social platform. You can all subscribe to my brand new Substack. It is called Hot Gay Nerd.
What's it about?
Truth in advertising.
No.
I'll be talking about television, culture, politics. Have I ever maintained a Substack before? No. Will it be weekly? Yes. And you can also follow me on Twitter for as long as I'm using that app, at Santiago Reports. It is a private account, but if you look like a real person and not a spam bot, I will accept you.
Great.
So that's Hot Gay Nerd on Substack.
Sarah D. Bundy.
It's time for more true crime. My first show is Captive Audience. It's a docuseries that dropped last week on Hulu, a three-parter that starts out as the story of Stephen Stainer, who is the titular Stephen in I Know My First Name is Stephen, foundational true crime miniseries content from the late 80s.
Yep.
Then Captive Audience moves into another even darker chapter of his family story. I can't really say much more without spoiling it, although various cases and their outcomes have been public knowledge for like decades now. But still, I feel like it's better to have gone into this not having second screened it. The question is whether Captive Audience is worth your time, with the full disclosure that an esteemed colleague of mine, Piper Weiss, is a producer on the docuseries. That entirely aside, yes, I would say it is. If nothing else, it was, to me at least, because I spent so much of my working life thinking about how true crime is told and sold. It is a fascinating study in different ways into narratives and the layers of storytelling that start to inform not just true crime consumers, but also each other within a given property. In this case, the filmmakers have Corin Nemec, who played teenage Stephen in the late 80s miniseries on Stephen's case, and who, not for nothing, also played Ted Bundy at one point, which, him? Anyway, this is never mentioned by the miniseries, but I bring it up every time I even see him. I'll just like stop people on the street. I'm like, did you know Corin Nemec played Ted Bundy? That's fucked up, right? Anyway.
Yeah, it's like Daniel Radcliffe playing Ted Bundy, if it were historically.
I mean, possible. I think I've played Ted Bundy, my now, like Zac Efron. What is happening?
I mean, I think I had a tweet at one point that was like, not every young actor will play Ted Bundy, but they do all have to register for the Ted Bundy draft and just hope their number doesn't come up.
Yeah. Chad Michael Murray got called and he did the best he could as a conscientious objector, but it was a lot of mannequin parts and I'm still a little upset. Anyway, Nemec is in this property, Captive Audience, reading transcripts of interviews that were conducted with the real-life people in the case by the miniseries screenwriter. Say that five times fast. This is what I'm talking about with the layers. It starts with a like avant-garde idea about the American Horror Story part of the Chronicle of the Stainers, but it feels like Hulu was like, no, what we do here is three-part docuseries, and this is going to be the shape and the arc of it. So Captive Audience kind of tries to fit everything it's trying to say into that more traditional limited series format. I don't know if this story and this documentary team is built for that. I think the ideal version of Captive Audience, which already put me in mind of both some of Robert Kolker's work and of casting JonBenet, which I think was underrated, the ideal version of this story leans as hard as it can into that meta, second order, avant-garde stuff, like all dramatic rereadings, all funky camera setups, full-on casting JonBenet-style reconception of what a documentary can do. Maybe that's because it's my job to review true crime properties and I'm just a little bit bored of this stentorian prestige-y and now the third act. Like, ugh. Anyway, I think that's the only way to truly get your narrative arms around a case like this family's, which is taking a completely different angle and zooming in as far as you can. But I think the best version of Captive Audience isn't this, and this version is still pretty good. I recommend it. It's 3 45-ish minute episodes. It's worth your time. It's a crazy story. And director Jessica Dimmock, who directed one of the new Unsolved Mysteries episodes, you can hear her thinking. And that's something. So hopefully this lets this team do something a little more suited to their style of thinking about this genre. Okay, Gaslit on Stars. Speaking of random prosthetics, this is the Watergate/Martha Mitchell joint with Julia Roberts as the so-called Mouth from the South. This one is like a subverted version of what I was saying about being the best version of itself, because this thinks it's the best version of anything. The first episode is smelling its own farts so audibly. Like, here is Oscar winner Sean Penn wearing 81 pounds of prosthetic foam just from the chin up.
He looks like Mr. Creosote from The Meaning of Life. He looks crazy.
he looks like Christian Clemenson's like gooey devil in that Buffy episode. No. Yeah. And he has to say the word vagina and to enunciate that from behind this literal baffle of prosthetic makeup. And yet... he's actually pretty good. I mean, and then Julia Roberts, she's not perfectly cast, but she is loving it. Here's the MVP, as she almost always is, Betty Gilpin. She's the goddamn best. Yep. She actually distracts from Dan Stevens's fairly terrible Midwestern accent as John Dean. If you can get past a certain amount of clumsy, listy exposition, past the writer really thinking that it's awesome to make characters be completely crass in every single line of dialogue, smug production design, like it's both beautiful to look at and annoying, but it's also a pleasure to watch these performers at work. Hamish Linklater's Jeb Magruder is such a well-actually little quad. It's really a lot of fun. It's a it's a true story that I know well, but this is still just fun to watch. And you don't have to watch it all that closely because it's not only going to tell you everything you already know, it's going to tell you how smartly it's doing it. And the outfits are really fun to look at. So give it until Gilpin shows up. And if you still can't with it, bail, but I am in for a couple more episodes. I reviewed both of these joints for my true crime newsletter, bestevidence.fyi, along with a very British Scandals Duchess of Argyle series and tons of other stuff. My co-editor Eve Beatty and I welcome your paid subscriptions because that lets us pay our outstanding contributors a slightly larger pittance, but most of our content is free and we would love to have you read it. bestevidence.fyi, come on through.
Wanda Maximoff should have had three of her own Marvel movies by now. She's personally my favorite MCU character, compelling, the strongest Avenger, and her superpower manifests through voguing. She's very interesting in the fact that she turns. Watch Age of Ultron. She's just
no.
Voguing.
You're right.
No, you're right. I just never thought of it that way.
And she's really interesting in the fact that she turns the expectation of what makes a strong superhero on its head and how you measure strength when it comes to superpowers. She's not just strong because of how much she can destroy, but how much she can create. And her narrative journey comes to a crescendo in WandaVision's 8th episode previously on. When WandaVision begins, Wanda had lost everything in her life. She lost her parents when she was a child in war-torn... what's the country's name? Sokovia?
Sokovia.
Yeah, thank you. Her twin brother was killed, and her entire home country was completely destroyed that same day. And then she had to kill her partner, Vision, to stop Thanos, only for him to immediately reverse time and kill him again right in front of her. Don't know why I'm recapping that. It's the highest-grossing movie ever. But just to catch you all up. Now, from here, she chooses to live in a fantasy world. Dave, please play clip one.
Who are you?
Who are you? All those costumes and hairstyles. Oh, I was so patient. Waiting for you to reveal your true self. I got close with fake Fietro. You will, but no dice.
That was you.
No, it wasn't literally me, just my eyes and ears. A Cristallo possession. Necromancy was a non-starter since your real brother's body is on another continent. Not to mention full of holes. But you're so crippled by your own self-doubt that you believed it.
She wanted to believe that her brother Pietro was still alive, so in her delusions, she let him become a plotline in this TV show that she was creating. She put herself through hell to keep up the facade because the alternative of facing reality was just too much for her to bear. Dave, clip two.
Listen, I need you. Hey, Wanda. I need you to tell me how you did this.
I didn't do anything. I'm not.
I tried to be gentle, to nudge you awake from this ridiculous fantasy. But you'd rather fall apart than face your truth.
Now we're beginning to understand why classic TV? Why escape into this format of an illusion? And the answer is because as a child, her family would watch classic American sitcoms to distract the kids from the horrors of war that were happening right on their street, which we hear in clip 3.
This is your pick, yes?
Season 2, episode 21.
Dick Van Dyke again? Always sitcom.
The Wallet episode. Отличный избор.
Yes, Rob and Laura have for the most fun shenanigans.
What is shenanigan again?
Shenanigan is like problem, but more silly than scary, but can sometimes be a little scary.
Yeah, like mischief.
But a silly mischief. That always becomes fine.
Okay, Papa, start it for us.
The Dick Van Dyke Show. Starring Dick Van Dyke. Mary Tyler Moore.
Silly mischief that always becomes fine. That is what her dad said as soldiers fought on the street outside their window moments before a bomb killed him and his wife right in front of their children. She holds on to what he said for 2 days, hiding in the rubble with a ticking bomb threatening her. All the while, the Dick Van Dyke Show continues to flicker on the TV right next to the bomb in clip 4.
By the end of the episode, you realize it was all a bad dream. None of it was real.
None of it was real, she convinced herself. Trauma and escape into television are inextricably linked for Wanda. It is her coping mechanism. And WandaVision came out at a time when the world was doing the exact same thing. We were and are experiencing an unfathomable trauma, and how many of us chose to avoid confronting that pain was by turning to television. Tiger King, The Queen's Gambit, every minute of television that we watched was a minute that we weren't confronting our grief. And in this way, Wanda is the most relatable Avenger. Years later, after the bomb incident, when her brother died and Sokovia was destroyed, she fell back into old habits, watching Malcolm in the Middle to escape the pain. But this time, she is not alone. She has Vision with her. This next clip is long, but it's crucial. Dave, clip 5, please.
It is funny because of the grievous injury the man just suffered.
No, he's not really injured.
Ah. How can you be certain?
It's not that kind of show.
Wanda, I don't presume to know what you're feeling, but I would like to know
Should you wish to tell me, should that be of some comfort to you?
What makes you think that talking about it would bring me comfort?
Oh, see, I read that...
The only thing that would bring me comfort is seeing him again. Wave washing over me again and again. It knocks me down, and when I try to stand up, it just comes for me again. And I can't. It's just gonna drown me.
No. No, it won't.
How do you know?
Well, because it can't all be sorrow, can it? I've always been alone, so I don't feel the lack. It's all I've ever known. I've never experienced loss because I've never had a loved one to lose. But what is grief, if not love persevering?
These 2 minutes really capture the entire thesis of the show. It starts with Wanda saying that, oh, he's not really injured. It's not that kind of a show. She created a world where she's not really hurt. It's not that kind of a show. It'll all resolve in 22 minutes. And seeing Pietro again, seeing Vision again, brings her comfort. Because if she doesn't maintain this illusion, the grief will wash over her again and again, knocking her down every time she tries to stand up, and she's afraid that it will drown her. I thought it was a really beautiful description of the pain of grieving a loved one. I remember when I first saw it, thinking that that is how I felt every time I thought of my grandma dying from COVID alone behind a plastic sheet, the wave hitting me over and over again. But in the third part of that clip, Vision offers an alternative view. He says, I've never experienced loss because I've never had a loved one to lose. But what is grief if not love persevering? The grief is there to remind us, to remind Wanda, of the amazing love that we had. It tethers us to their memory and, in a way, keeps our loved ones alive with us. It's a speech that gives Wanda the strength to finally confront her grief and to grow. One quick aside, Elizabeth Olsen is an incredible actress, and the actress that plays her mom really gave off similar vibes, and you can believe that they're related. And of course, the iconic Catherine Hahn is just amazing throughout the entire season. So finally, Dave, please play Surprise Clip 6.
Who's been messing up everything?
It's been Agatha all along.
Who's been pulling every evil string?
It's been Agatha.
You haven't even noticed, and the pity is the pity. It's too late to fix anything now that everything has gone wrong. Thanks to Agatha, naughty Agatha.
It's been Agatha all along.
And I killed Sparky too.
That's actually from a different episode and is not part of my official argument, but it still slaps, and I thought everyone would like to hear it. This show was a beautiful character study of one of the most complex heroes in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And this episode in particular captures the character development that she goes through. And I hope you will admit it into the canon.
First of all, Santiago, I'm sorry about your grandma.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I wasn't saying that for pity. I was saying that for context.
Well, you're going to take my pity and you're going to take it. There was a lot of this episode. Like, I felt like I just kept making the same note over and over that was like, this is just like, I know it's good acting and I know I'm not supposed to say anything against Catherine Hahn, which I'm not going to do. This is not her fault, but this is like 78% a talking villain episode, just going on and going on. And it's like, oh my God, why? I mean, talk about Insidious. Like, it sort of sneaks up on you with these ideas that you don't usually see, like Santiago was talking about, in like just scripted narrative about grief, about the ways that it doesn't go away at the end of the hour. And it's not, you know, like, oh, it's not that kind of show, like the show that we've all been in for the last 2+ years. And in some ways, 5+ years. I mean, it actually is that kind of show and you don't get to turn it off. So the fact that this is really, you know, a meditation on both this character and on the nature of grief, but also on our sort of collective situation, I think really saves it from like, yes, Agatha is doing a lot of like, and then there's this, and you know, then I'm going to torture you in this way and try to get information. And that can be exhausting, but so can grief. And also you don't get any answers with grief either. And then having just watched Paul Bettany being a complete shit sack in A Very British Scandal for 3 hours, to return to this performance and this line, like, what is grief if not love persevering? You really have to nail that delivery, and he does. And the acting from both of them is just extraordinary. I have seen the better part of the season. I just hadn't seen this episode yet. But that was just a sort of breathtaking line that, like, I'm looking at my notes and it's like, I wrote that line down and then I made a little check mark and then I just stopped writing things down. Cause like, we're done. Like, thank you. This had a lot of opportunities to tip over into congratulating itself on its own insight that didn't happen. Catherine Hahn is doing a good job with, I think, a sort of thankless talking villain thing. I do love the song. How can I not? But yeah, I think that it pretty skillfully turns that Moebius of trauma and escape into TV, both in the subject matter and in our lives in the last couple of years. This was a lovely presentation and, you know, like sad. It made me sad to watch this, but also a little hopeful and good performances. And it's good. It's really good. Good 48 minutes of TV.
Well, not 2 hours.
Not 2 hours. Didn't need 2 hours.
This episode, I thought, was clever in its delivery. And I will say, like, after this episode is where this show decides that it can no longer be a good show, but it has to be a Marvel show.
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is like the last hurrah for this show. And it is a good episode. But for me, this episode is basically, how can we rework, like, a Tony Soprano sitting with Dr. Melfi episode? And that's what this is. It's basically her on the couch going through her past traumas, why she's built the way she is. They just built it around this, you know, going through portals. And instead of your psychiatrist, it's the evil other witch steering the session. And like, that's an entertaining way to do that, because God knows I hate sitting on the couch scenes and stuff like that. So if they went that route, you know, and functionally it's the same, but it was much more entertaining to go through all these portals and, you know, see the Hydra scenes and, you know, see the Sokovia scenes and all that sort of stuff. So I appreciate its delivery, and I appreciate that this is the sort of the climax of WandaVision: the study of grief. Beaver becomes WandaVision, ad for Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness or whatever it ended up being at the end there. Because I really enjoyed WandaVision up until the point where it had to be an advertisement for the next Marvel thing. I know I don't want to relitigate that because we've talked about it ad nauseum. Yeah. That is to say, this was the last episode where I was like, yay, oh, WandaVision. I really do appreciate the delivery and how they did, you know, do a twist on something that is pretty rote in television and pop culture. Which is like the study of the past reasons for their grief. And like, yeah, her and Bethany are great together. I will no longer think of anything else but voguing now when she's doing her dark magic.
It really is.
Yeah. And when Doctor Strange does it too, honestly.
Oh,
yeah, that's true. But she's got the hand stuff more.
Category is hands.
Especially in Age of Ultron, where she's doing a lot of stuff like over and around the head.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All the flourishes. Where's
just needs a couple pin curls, and it's speaking of IP problems.
I guess it's fitting that me, the Marvel poo-pooer, is going last and that my vote doesn't matter, it sounds like. But I think that I wanted more Catherine Hahn rather than less. I hear what you're saying about the talking villain, but like it starts out being her sort of gatekeeping witchcraft in a way that I thought was really funny, where she's like, you don't even know what you're doing. Like you haven't learned all the, you know, you haven't learned spells. You don't know what these runes do. Like you're just, you know, bumbling through whatever, blah, blah, blah. We know she's a Scarlet
Witch. You're just fire starter.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. But then she sort of disappears as the show, you know, it's spent the previous 7 episodes showing us sitcoms, you know, styles from different eras. And now we've arrived at the clip show where we're seeing clips from Wanda's life. But I wanted more of, because now that we know what Agatha is, like, I wanted more of her. She's so good. Like, you hear it in that song. That's really her singing and her with her, like, you know, crazy, like, feathered edges.
And she, in her flashback's position scene, there's this interesting parallel where she ends up all by herself and isn't feeling the loss, but that's because she's a little fucking sociopath.
Yeah. And
Catherine Hahn's acting in that and the way she can get regret, but also like bratty triumph in the same expression.
Yeah.
Delightful look on her face.
Yeah. Yes. Catherine Hahn is not the issue. It was a little bit more the structuring of the dialogue between them. She's awesome. Anyway, continue.
But, you know, we did have to, I guess, find out, like, why she's so fixated on her own comfort canon, as it were. Hear more about that and extra, extra upgrade this week.
There you
but,
go.
You know, did I take that personally? Yes. Loving TV doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. And ultimately, the fact that this had to be, like, just the latest trauma plot where, you know, it was in the same year as Cruella, where we had to find out, like, oh no, we're going to redeem the puppy killer too. Like, she also has a tragic origin story where it's just like, this is the thing that's running through all of TV. And like Dave chillingly saying during the I'm Not a Crackpot segment, like, we might come to a time when all TV is IPTV. That's my fear. And like, for all of the praise that the show got for its depiction of grief, and I don't disagree, it's like, can't we just have these people write a show about grief that doesn't have to have superheroes? You know what I mean? Like, there are other ways to do this beyond, like, we're going to graft this thing onto what is supposed to be, like, fun.
Or just have a superhero who got hit by lightning and who's fine with it and has living parents and it's not a big fucking deal.
Yeah, whatever. But the flip side is people that consume that sort of content only would never be exposed to something like that otherwise, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, it's you know, here's the sugar and, you know, and then the medicine right behind it kind of thing.
Guess.
I mean,
Why does Marvel have to give any medicine at all?
Yeah.
No, but they did.
Just
and I think it's fine.
Straight high fructose corn syrup. Why not?
Eh. Well, that's like saying we own this city should have no moments of levity. It's the opposite argument.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think either one.
All right. I mean, we're not going to agree on this. Like,
there's not enough voguing and we own the city. We all agree. Let's not fight.
All right.
That's true. I'll say as a closer is that, you know, love persevering line got a lot of attention at the time. And it is a good line. But in my opinion, you're supposed to be a myth, a being capable of spontaneous creation. And here you are using it to make breakfast for dinner is a better line, in my opinion, and should have gotten more shine.
Yeah, Brenner is awesome.
All right, let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting, what do you think on this one?
I mean, yes.
Okay, fine. All right. Tara Ariana, what say you?
No, but thank you for the presentation.
All right. I got to say yes. Don't worry about Tara.
Yay!
Gabby. WandaVision Season 1, Episode 8. Previously on, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Who has this week's winner?
I do. I have an honorable mention first to Chad Lowe for booking the role he was meant to play, playing Rob Lowe's character's brother on 911 Lone Star. Congratulations to the Strands. But my actual winner is Katherine Heigl, because Ellen Pompeo, many years, over a decade since Katherine Heigl got fired off Grey's Anatomy for being difficult, Ellen Pompeo has belatedly backed her up for publicly complaining about the punitively long hours on Grey's. Ellen now says, yeah, she was right. She should have said it. It's like, well, maybe you should have taken her side back then and she would still have this job and be rich like you. Just a thought.
And Loser League?
The Loser of the Week, and I also have an honorable mention, and it is Aaron Sorkin's dialogue, because Josh Charles, in an interview at Esquire published, I guess, yesterday.
By Dave Holmes, I believe.
By Dave Holmes, past guest of the show. Dave Holmes was like, so, you know, what was it like to get an Aaron Sorkin script? It must have been great, like Christmas morning, right? And he's literally like, eh. And Dave Holmes goes, eh? And then Josh Charles is given like 78 off ramps to go back to Sorkin as a generational genius, and he takes none of them, and he's like, look, you know, the guy's in the Hall of Fame and everything, he doesn't need my help, I'm just saying not every script was awesome and you're not moving me off this. So yes, yeah, Sorkin, a rare loser, except always kind of in our hearts. The real loser is Killing Eve, because the author of the books that the show is based on publicly complained about the ending of the TV series. And based on my Twitter feed, I quit the show a season and a half ago, but based on my Twitter feed, not the only objector.
Yeah.
Speaking about rough, you know what time it is?
Ooh.
It's not regulation game time.
Fuck yeah.
It is non-regulation game time. Dave has cashed in one of his previous wins for this game, which I am calling It's Almost Like the DC Tri-State Area is Another Character. To bring us back to our lead topic, and its very distinctive setting, this is a sequel to Back to the Garden State from when we had Alan Sepinwall on to talk about The Many Saints of Newark. Once again, it is a game in two parts. In part one, I'll give you the description of a TV show that an actor from We Own This City was in within the last 12 months. You tell me the show title for 2 points. If you need a hint, I will tell you what network or platform it was on, and then it's worth 1 point. In part two, you are guessing TV series that, per my research, are set in Maryland, Virginia, or Washington, D.C. If you get the title off the description, it is 2 points. After a hint of its network or platform, it's worth 1. This is very Googleable. You are on your individual honor not to cheat while we play. I'm not giving any free guesses, but in part two, there is a bonus point available. I'll let you try for that even if you don't get the show. I will ask you if you can tell me which of those three locations the show is set in. And if you get it, you get a point. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with David.
All right. Our order is Dave, Santiago, Sarah, are you ready to play? It's Almost Like the DC Tri-State Area is Another Character.
Yes.
All right.
Sure.
Part one. Question one is for Dave. Wunmi Misako starred in this superhero series about a trickster with godlike powers.
Loki.
Loki is correct for 2 points. Santiago. Josh Charles guest starred in this police procedural spinoff built around a beloved but controversial New York City detective with a big dump truck.
SVU Organized Crime?
I can't. It's Law and Order Organized Crime.
Oh my god. Did I say SVU? Yes. Oh, fuck. I meant Law and Order.
I'd be okay if you accepted that, but okay.
Sarah.
Yes.
Leah Pressman starred in this procedural slash drama about a family of New York cops.
Blue Bloods?
Blue Blood is good for 2 points. Dave.
Bay Ridge's own.
Dave, Don Harvey starred in this docudrama about the fallout from the infamous robbery at a Malibu estate.
I guess I'll take the hint.
Hulu.
No, ain't got it.
Pam and Tommy.
Malibu?
Yep, he played Anthony Pelicano.
Right.
Oh, God.
Santiago. John Bernthal appeared in this anthology series created by an Office alumnus who for some reason thought his own name and face would be a great way to market it.
A hint.
This was on, when this was still a thing, FX on Hulu.
Rainn Wilson's Variety Hour.
Do I want to see that? Not really, but I didn't want to see this either. It was BJ Novak's The Premise.
Oh my God, I forgot that existed.
So did That's I.
Correct. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
Dagmara Domenchik starred in this dark comedy about a family of media moguls.
Dark comedy about a family of... Succession?
Succession is correct. Back to Dave. This is everyone's last question in round one. Dave, Dominic Lombardozzi starred in this Hawaii set remake about a sailor turned private investigator.
Well, I assume that's Magnum P.I.
That's correct.
Don't know who that is, but
okay. That he's the bald guy from the Fuzzy Dunlop guy from The Wire.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That guy. Santiago, McKinley Belcher III starred in this preposterously long-running crime drama about a money-laundering couple.
Oh, money. Oh, I have an idea. Hint, please.
It is on Netflix.
Never seen this show. No idea what it's about.
Uh-huh.
Just gonna guess.
Yep.
Ozark?
Ozark's correct.
Hey!
Oh, shit! Okay.
It's finally good for something.
Hey. And the final question of round one for Sarah. Jamie Hector starred in this L.A. Noir cop show that's about to get a lateral spinoff.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-bosh!
Correct for 2 points. All right, let's get a score break before we move into part two.
All right, between the parts, Santiago has 1 point, David T. Cole has 4 points, and I am currently leading with 6 points.
All right, let's get into part two. Still guessing shows. David T. Cole. This short-lived procedural spinoff followed experts who specialized in solving tech and computer crimes.
Sorry, we're now on things that are set in...
These are all set in D.C., Maryland, or Virginia.
Is that CSI Cyber?
It sure is for 2 points. Which of those three locations do you believe it was set in?
Virginia.
Virginia is correct. Santiago. This series take on a successful action film franchise features a nerd turned spy. You can ask for a hint. It'll be the platform or network once again.
Hint.
Amazon Prime Video.
Okay, that's what I thought it might have been. Is it Jack Reacher?
No!
Oh.
None! You were so close. It's Jack Ryan.
Oh, right.
Oh, my God.
But you can still get the bonus point. Where do you think it was set?
DC?
CIA. Right?
1 in 3 chance.
Virginia.
Yeah, CIA.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Sarah D. Bunting. This period drama revolves around a close-knit rural family starting in the Great Depression and running through World War II.
Really resisting seeing Downton Abbey because that's not it.
I mean, they are rural in a sense.
I guess.
Houses
exactly.
In the country.
And, you know, change is coming.
Mm-hmm.
I need a hint.
I'm not sure this will help you, but it was on CBS. I guess it kind of helped you when I said was. It's not on
Home front? Is it All Fly Away? Fucker.
Okay. No, it's the Waltons. No reaction. Do you have a guess as to which of the three locations it was set in?
Let's try Virginia.
Virginia's correct.
Yay!
For 1 point. Back to Dave.
Uh-huh.
This sitcom features a highly placed female politician and her variously competent staff.
Veep?
Veep is correct for 2 points. Where is Veep set, Dave?
DC.
DC is correct.
Dave takes the lead.
I'm still kicking myself over SVU.
Sorry.
Aren't we all?
This is for you. This docudrama profiles 3 spouses of U.S. presidents.
Oh, God. Is it singular or plural? The first lady? Singular?
Yay!
Yes.
Good for 2 points. Okay. And where is it set?
D.C.
That's correct. For 1 point.
I hope it's in D.C.
Sarah.
Yep.
This short-lived sci-fi spinoff makes protagonists of its origin show's recurring trio.
The Lone Gunman.
That is correct for 2 points. And where is it set?
Where is that fucker set? I don't feel like they were actually in D.C. I'm going to say Virginia.
Was Maryland, according to Wikipedia.
Okay.
Who knows? Back to David T. Cole.
Yeah.
This popular sitcom covered the antics of a clumsy secret agent and his eminently capable sidekick.
Get Smart.
Good for 2 points. Where was it set?
I'm going to assume Virginia. Ooh.
D.C., apparently.
Really?
Yep.
I was going to guess the Tick.
Secret organization.
You were going to the Tick?
Spoon.
Santiago, this spy drama, loosely adapted from an Israeli format, kicks off with a suspected sleeper agent returning home from war.
I'm going to guess not the Angelina Jolie film Salt.
Where's the pity?
It's
a good fucking movie.
Hint, please.
This was on Showtime.
Oh my God, Homeland.
Homeland's good for 1 point. And where was it set?
I watched maybe 2 episodes of Homeland when it first came out.
You're fine.
Smart.
Virginia?
That's correct for 1 point.
Okay, great.
DC also correct, apparently.
I remember a house in the suburbs.
Yeah.
So I figured not DC.
You were right. All right, let's give this one to Sarah, and then we'll do another score break. Sarah, this family drama concerns a teenage girl who starts communicating directly with God.
Joan of Arcadia.
That's good for 2 points. And where was it set?
In my heart.
And your heart,
Maryland.
It is Maryland. Good job. All right, let's get those.
Something had to be Maryland.
Let's get those scores.
Well, I was going to say there's been a lead change, and there sort of has. Santiago making a charge towards the front with 6 points. David T. Cole and I are currently tied with 12 points.
Oh, exciting. David T. Cole.
Yeah.
I was waiting for the music to stop.
I know, and then I decided not to stop it.
Charge!
Okay, Dave.
Yeah.
This sci-fi drama pairs an alien-obsessed FBI agent with a skeptical partner.
That could be anything. The start of that, I was about to blurt out Alien Nation because it's been in my head since we watched the movie.
But you know that's
sounds
LA.
Like The X-Files.
This is The X-Files for 2 points. And where was it set?
Well, that's got to... Shit, where are they? They're an offshoot of the FBI. Which means they should be in D.C.
Correct.
I was about to say Virginia because it's all secret shit, but that's CIA.
But they're not at Lane.
FBI is right there in the...
Quantico.
Unless they're being trained, in which case...
Yes, unless they're being trained, being constantly probed to build up their tolerance.
Santiago.
Story of my life.
Boom.
This multiple Emmy-winning drama about a fictional Democratic presidential administration continues to break liberal brains to this day.
Okay, yeah. The West Wing?
That's good for 2 points. And where was it set?
Kentucky? D.C.
It is in D.C. Sarah.
Yes.
This sitcom finds a journalist, single mother, unexpectedly falling for and marrying a career military officer.
A journalist, single mother, falling for and marrying... God. It's a sitcom, you said?
It is a sitcom, I said.
I don't know. So,
like,
but I have
hint?
To guess. Major Dad.
It is Major Dad. And where was that set?
Well, the thing is that it could have been set in one of three places.
That's right.
And there are some forts
in some
places. And I just feel like maybe the biggest fort is Washington, D.C.
Virginia.
God damn it, Virginia.
Back to Dave.
Yeah.
This drama speculates about what might ensue after a president and his entire cabinet are killed in a terrorist attack.
Yeah. Shit, what is that called? Hang on, give me a sec. Mm-hmm. Keith Sutherland. He's got the special colored button or something. And it's not Lone, it's a designated survivor.
Good for nice 2 points.
Nice pull.
And where is it set?
DC.
Yes. Not I always weather. Forget, and I was reminded when I looked it up, that there's a Korean remake of it.
What was his cabinet position again? He was like
Education Secretary.
Wow. Santiago. Who cares? Santiago, this drama, a spinoff sequel to an Oscar-winning movie, joins a young FBI agent getting back to work after a life-changing case.
Hint.
CBS.
Right.
Oh, yeah, that thing.
Yes. Oh, of course. That thing that I definitely know the name of.
That thing?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And that name is as follows.
Yeah.
And the name, which will be said henceforth.
You're filling the silence very well, by the way.
The Big Bang Theory.
I tried, guys.
Dave or Sarah?
Clarice.
Santiago.
Oh, my God. Another show I forgot existed.
He still gets the location question.
Right? Yes. So where was it set, do you think?
I'm going to go with Virginia.
Really? No Quantico?
She was a trainee, so it should have been Virginia, but...
But she, by the time it was the show, she was...
She was
done.
Right. All right.
Sarah D. Bunting. I'll give you this, and then we'll have another score break. This accidentally homoerotic teen drama spinoff takes place at an exclusive boys' boarding school.
Young Americans?
Yep.
Wow.
Which of the three locations did it take place in, Sarah?
I feel like Virginia's gonna fuck me again, but I'm going to say Maryland.
Maryland is correct. Good job. Nice. Let's get those scores.
Okay. It gets ever closer. However, we do have a new leader. Santiago has 9 points. I have 17 points. And David T. Cole has 18 points. What will happen?
Let's find out. Dave. This drama is about Soviet spies posing as citizens of an enemy nation.
You know, I know the answer right away for a lot of these, but then I pause for a second to think, is there like a doppelganger show? Because, you know, like, but I'm going to assume that's the Americans.
It is the Americans for 2 points. And where was that?
Yeah, from? Where do they live? Okay, so it's not D.C., I think. I mean, they live in a house. Usually when people live in houses... going to be in one of those two. I'm just going to roll the dice and say Maryland. Oh, no! I'm open the door.
They were in D.C.
Fuck. Really?
Yep. Hmm. Santiago, this sitcom spinoff followed its protagonist as she departed Brooklyn Heights for studies at an HBCU. This show may be older than you. I will give you that supplementary hint.
What is HB? What does that stand for?
Historically Black College or University.
Oh, right. Okay. I mean, I'm guessing this character went to Howard, in which case it's set in DC, but I don't know the show.
Sarah?
Well, I was going to guess Grown-ish, but that's wrong. It's a different world, right?
It is a different world. And DC is your guess for location?
Mm-hmm.
It was in Virginia.
What?
It's a fictional place, but it was in Virginia.
Oh,
Spellman.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Coward. Yes.
A recent supporting actress Oscar winner broke out as a teen in this family sitcom set in its namesake apartment building.
Is that in its namesake apartment building? Melrose Place?
Who was the teen in that family sitcom known as Melrose Place? No, it's 227.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hey,
and
lady.
Where was 227 set?
I did not realize this. I'm going to guess D.C.
It is D.C. And the Oscar winner, for those who are screaming at their phones, it was Regina King.
I just was not listening and went straight to Melrose. Sorry.
My brain went to Melrose, too, and I just wouldn't get off it was the problem. Yeah.
Back to Dave.
Yeah.
This short-lived political drama tells the story of a female vice president who gets a big promotion after the president's death.
Yeah. Okay, wait, read it again.
This short-lived political drama tells the story of a female vice president who gets a big promotion after the president's death.
Okay.
And remember, no show's in here more than once.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to base this. I got two options, but I'm just going to base this answer on which one died on the vine quicker.
Yeah.
Fuck, what was it called?
That's
okay,
the question.
Here's what, I'm just going to talk it out since there's no stealing. Mm. I don't think it's Madam President. I think it's Commander in Chief.
Nice.
It's Commander in Chief. Madam Secretary. Is
Madam Secretary, yes.
Yeah, she's not the Vice President at the start. She's a Secretary of something.
Secretary of State.
All right, where? Thank you.
And
where,
she's definitely not Hillary Clinton.
She sure isn't. Dave, where was Commander in Chief set?
I'm going to assume it's D.C.
You're right.
All right.
Nice.
Santiago. This not-so-accidentally homoerotic horror drama stars a troubled FBI profiler and the shrink he becomes obsessed with.
I'm going to go with Hannibal.
There's
correct.
Boy.
Where was it set?
Wolf Trap, which makes it Virginia.
Oh, nice.
Also in Maryland for the Hannibal scenes because he was at Johns Hopkins or something. Anyway, either of those would have been correct. Sarah.
Yes.
This drama was the cat and mouse tale of an FBI agent and the cult leader who keeps eluding him.
Oh, for God's sake. Oh, Poehead. The Following.
The Following is correct. And where was it set?
I mean, it's Poe, so Maryland?
Correct.
Woo!
Dave. Hey,
buddy. Yeah.
We were cruelly denied a third season of this docudrama about the earliest days of FBI profiling.
Docudrama?
Well, like based on true events, but it's scripted.
Read it again.
We were cruelly denied a third season of this docudrama about the earliest days of FBI profiling.
Yeah, I forgot about that and now I'm mad again.
Mm.
Spoilers, snuck low.
Oh, is it, Oh, wait. I'm going to get the name wrong because I always get the name wrong. Think it out. I always want to say the title of the movie, which is Manhunter. So this is Mindhunter.
Mindhunter is correct for two points. And where was it set?
D.C.
That's right. Also Virginia, apparently.
Okay.
Santiago. This post-apocalyptic drama let us all know what might happen if sexy teen delinquents were sentenced to recolonize Earth.
Is that shit still on? I feel like it is.
Oh! The 100?
Yeah!
Nice.
Wow. And where was it set in a post-apocalyptic future?
No fucking idea.
Is that a viable gene pool?
Trick question. It's a post-apocalyptic future. States don't exist anymore.
But
I think we got to give to.
Green.
Yeah.
All right, fine.
He caught you. Gotcha.
Virginia, apparently, according to the
internet. Either way, I don't think you're at risk of being forced to watch that episode, Tara. I think you're fine.
Sarah, this teen drama involves an abducted girl trying to start over after rejoining her family.
Oh my God, are there half of this is just shows that only I watch? It's Finding Carter, right?
Yeah. Jesus, where was that
Justice
set?
From Elena Govich. Where was that shit set? Virginia.
That's right. Let's get a score break before you all have your final question.
Oh boy. Well, a couple of things could happen, and I guess we'll find out what they are. First, let me tell you that Santiago has 15 points, I have 24 points, and David T. Cole has 26 points.
Oh, boy!
So he could choke, and I could win.
He could. Let's find out.
The last question is worth 12 points, right?
Yeah.
No.
That is tradition.
As is our tradition.
Dave.
Yeah.
In this long-running procedural, A forensic anthropologist uses her skills to assist the FBI.
Read that again.
In this long-running procedural...
But in a funny accent.
A forensic anthropologist uses her skills to assist the FBI. Paris! Not Paris.
A forensic anthropologist. What the fuck is a forensic anthropologist? Is this not well done? It's medium?
Oh, Dave.
What is it, Sarah?
It's Bones.
It is Bones.
Yeah, okay, it's Bones. I've never watched 1 second of Bones.
I thought it might have penetrated through from just like osmosis from the quiz show, because I assume it's been an answer once or twice or 50 times. Dave, where was Bones set? As it were.
Read the thing again?
She's a forensic anthropologist and she uses her skills to assist the FBI.
All right, so DC.
Correct. Also Maryland. Santiago. This bonkers drama follows the adventures of an extremely skilled crisis manager and her highly placed clients.
I'm going to go with Scandal.
Correct for 2 points.
Remember that thing?
Where was Scandal set?
That was set in DC.
Correct.
Nice.
It's handled.
Sarah D. Bunting. This period drama deals in the tradecraft of the American Revolutionary War.
Turn, colon, Washington spies.
That is good for 2 points. And where did that take place?
I mean, Washington, D.C. like didn't exist yet. Mm-hmm. So, Virginia.
That's right. Let's get the scores.
Oh, shit. Strong finish from Santiago with 18 points. David T. Cole and I are tied with 27 points each.
Oh, my God. Thank God we have a tiebreaker.
Yes.
Let me finish this whole sentence before you answer. The special agents in this procedural fight crime navally.
CSI.
NCIS.
No, NCIS. Fuck! God damn it.
Sarah got it.
Navally.
And the reason that's a tiebreaker is that it takes place in all three locations. It was the only one for which that was true. So
and international waters.
Congratulations, Sarah!
Thank you.
Sarah.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We hotwired our discussion of We Own This City before going around the dial with stops at We Crash, The Baby, RuPaul's Drag Race, Captive Audience, and Gaslit. And he also worked his magic to get WandaVision's previously on episode into the canon. Look at that, Vogan. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Next up, Comfort Cannon on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, TV Mom Thunderdome. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole on behalf of Tara.
Gotta go make breakfast for dinner.
Sarah.
Silly mischief that always becomes fine.
And Santiago.
Most of all, I need to thank Cornbread's ankle.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra. Hot great.
Ba 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 bosh.